of course, felony rioting, which is another thing altogether. So the government's theory of the case, laughable as it is that everyone who visited disruptj20.org did so in order to plan a crime. That theory is simply wrong, right? The Fourth Amendment was ratified in large part to prevent the government from issuing general warrants, right? The founders were very concerned about fishing expeditions, about a warrant that says, let's collect everything regardless of whether it's evidence of a crime or not and sift through it. You know, what essentially the government is doing here is they're doing the equivalent of going to a library and instead of saying, give us the name of this person who checked out this book on this day, they're telling the library, give us the name of everyone who's ever checked out a book at your library because one person may have committed vandalism after checking out a book. That's ridiculous.
Very quickly, Nate Cardozo, I wanted to get the Electronic Freedom Foundation's response to the web hosting company GoDaddy recently severing ties with the neo-Nazi website The Daily Stormer after the site posted an article mocking Heather Heyer, the anti-racist protester who was killed. You have 5 seconds.
We despise the sort of racist speech that Daily Stormer hosted, but we're very uncomfortable when infrastructure providers make the decision that I'm not allowed to read that speech. That does not seem like the proper role for a company like GoDaddy to take. The remedy for bad speech is more speech. It's not silencing
Nate Cardozo,
the bad speaker.
I want to thank you for being with us of Electronic Frontier Foundation. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by a fantastic group of people. Mike Burr, Nina Guzder, Nimi Shay, Carla Wills, Laura Katz-Diener. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn from Henry Ford College. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronik, station advisor here at WHFR.fm. Happy to have you with us today. Of course, our show is all about local news and alternative views from Dearborn and the surrounding area. A lot has been happening, ongoing, for the last, almost a year now, if November means anything to you last year. And so I'm not going to, since this show is focused on local issues, although everything nationally and internationally really does affect us too in some way or form, even though it's very far away. Even Charlottesville is far away from Dearborn. It would take you, 4 or 5 days to walk there? Well, nonetheless, it's a global village. We're all together trying to understand each other. And so every now and then we have to do reach beyond the boundaries. So renew our public spirit in a positive way. Here's an editorial opinion expressed on Michigan Public Radio by Jack Lessenberry from this last, I think it was Monday. But in any event, it sort of sums up, it does have an editorial comment about reacting to the horror in Charlottesville. But I think if you are part of the media or even social media, I'm talking about news media, but social media, you've had a big dose of that, if not an overdose of that story and consequences this week. But here's a comment that happened before this last Tuesday from Jack Lessenberry. See what you think.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. On the afternoon that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, my seventh grade math teacher decided the best thing he could do was ignore it. He reasoned that what was going on in the nation had nothing to do with his job, which was to teach math to a classroom of Michigan kids, and so he carried on, or tried to, ignoring that some of the students were crying and few could focus. I suspect the only thing any of his students remember about what he did that day was his irrational effort to act as if everything was normal. Since then, I've learned that what he did really wasn't all that crazy. When the world collapses into chaos, it's human nature to find some little island of rationality to cling to. Statues of Robert E. Lee have been in the news a lot lately, but here's a story about him you may not know. On Sunday, April 2, 1865, Lee informed Jefferson Davis during a church service that Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, could no longer be held. Davis responded by returning to his office and meticulously tidying it up before fleeing. Sometimes, indeed, it's right to shut the world out, no matter what. A surgeon with a patient on the table has to ignore everything else, even if the president has just been assassinated, or if, as happened yesterday, the president of the United States indulges in a bizarre performance that casts doubt on not only his fitness for office, but his sanity. That's not something I say lightly. I suggest, however, that instead of watching the entire bizarre episode, you take the old-fashioned analog step of reading a transcript of it. NBC's Brian Williams last night said words to the effect that yesterday afternoon proves that there's no such thing as normal anymore when it comes to this presidency. That's certainly true, but beyond the assertions of things that plainly have no basis in fact, beyond the claims that he knows the facts and nobody else does, there was this bizarre moment. Suddenly, apropos of nothing, President Trump said, "Does anyone know that I own a house in Charlottesville? I own, actually, one of the largest wineries in the United States. It's in Charlottesville." To me, this was as alarming as the lies in addressing a respected reporter as fake news. It's a clear indication that this president is unable to keep focused for more than a few moments on anything other than himself. I've read very widely in American history and can say that we've never had anything like this before. So, while I supposedly could have talked this afternoon about the state attorney general's race or what might happen with NAFTA, I somehow couldn't rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic today. We have an all-encompassing problem, and it's not limited to the chief executive's willingness to legitimize hate groups. For the present, we don't have rational leadership. What happens now is anyone's guess, but this is something that cannot be ignored and that has implications for the world and for every county in Michigan, from Allegan past Wexford to Wayne. Journalists, including myself, thrive on excitement and breaking news. Today, for the first time ever, I crave boring instead.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
So that's somewhat measured comments compared to, what comments he made at MichiganRadio.org after Tuesday, and that we heard multiple places after Tuesday. One of the things that is happening that's positive here in Michigan, and it's in the Detroit Metro Times, metrotimes.com, for this week. In fact, it was just posted yesterday on their website. Michigan gerrymandering petition has been okayed to circulate. So here's the story. Voters Not Politicians, that's a group behind an effort to change the state constitution to end political gerrymandering in Michigan. Again, gerrymandering is the term expressing some political bias, in fact, in the way that the lines are drawn for the districts, the representatives and the senators, the districts in Michigan to be elected from. And the way you draw the boundaries, of course, all the districts should have about the same amount of population to make it fair, okay, for representatives. And of course, senators are elected statewide, except for Michigan senators. Michigan senators come from districts. So it's the national senators elected statewide. So they have the whole state. They don't have to worry about that gerrymandering issue. But everybody with a district within a state, those lines can be changed by the state legislature, by the majority of the people, of course, in the state legislature. That's the way democracy is done, by the majority. But this petition, this proposal that is going to be out to receive signatures may be on the ballot in November 2018. But they have to collect 316,000 valid signatures, which means they probably have to collect twice as many. So the group, again, you may see them around town going into the fall. Voters Not Politicians is the name of the group, and they're really anti-gerrymandering petition, or at least the way to end political gerrymandering, is going to be up for your consideration on the ballot if enough people sign that proposal. So according to a post on the group's Facebook page, so Voters Not Politicians have a Facebook page, the group plans to begin collecting signatures immediately with a signature collecting event currently scheduled for 5:30 p.m. at Motor City Brewing Works in Detroit. That was last night. So that's pretty immediate. And this proposal, which officials have described as one of the most complex ever submitted, would change Michigan's state constitution, establishing a 13-member citizens commission made up of five independent voters and four each from the two major parties. I think it's too bad we need any political parties represented, but everybody leans like one way or the other, but oh well. This would mean that neither political party would have the ultimate sway in decisions, though. Neither of the major political parties. So what are the minor political parties? What about the Green Party of Michigan? What about the Libertarian Party of Michigan and others? Are they chopped liver? That was an old term from the 50s. Actually, I like chopped liver myself, but anyway. It was a negative thing originally, I think. But nonetheless, this is the proposal. So the big political parties would have a slice of the action, but they wouldn't control the outcome because the five independent voters would control five of the 13 votes. And so they wouldn't have a majority either, but they could sway a vote or maybe even prevent a vote. I'm not sure how that would work out. But currently the drawing of Michigan's electoral districts is overseen by, as I said before, the state legislature. That's Republican-controlled. In 2014 and 2016 elections, the Michigan Democrats in state house races received nearly the same or more total votes than Republicans, and yet the Republicans managed to hold on to a majority. So it's got to show you, if nothing else does, that it is gerrymandered in an unfair, politically unfair way. So the group's spokesperson, Kirk Haverkamp, said, "We are working to end partisan control by either party. Gerrymandering disenfranchises voters of both parties, as well as independents, by locking them into districts where their votes don't matter. It also results in the election of more extreme candidates, because elections in gerrymandered safe districts tend to be determined in the primaries." And again, those are primaries where you could either vote Democrat or Republican, but there aren't any primaries allowed for Green Party or Libertarian Party candidates, which is kind of interesting, isn't it? That was all decided by whom? By the state legislature. By the major parties who want to keep control. I mean, if they're so good, why are they afraid of a little competition? Going on with the story, that was the story. Yep. So look for that ballot petition drive going on at your brewing works nearby or wherever they happen to see them. The group's name again is Voters Not Politicians, and they do have a Facebook page if you want to get involved. Since it's only just been approved and not reviewed, perhaps, or at least the League of Women Voters of Michigan have not decided if they would be in support of that or not. My personal feeling is they would be, but I haven't looked at it myself. If it is a very complex one, it's probably a long proposal, and it needs to be reviewed by politicians, but also people who are independent citizens who can try to hope that the cutting up of districts will not be so unfair in the future. In terms of the concept, I think on this show we have indicated, as has the League of Women Voters, that we're in favor of ending politically purposed gerrymandering because it is undemocratic. It's one of those things we can do to get democracy back to be a more true representation of the people. Again, we do not have direct democracy in this country. We have representative democracy, and therefore how those representatives are elected makes a big difference, okay, in terms of the number of voters that are able to vote for them in that district. So it's very, very important that you consider this. Again, they do have a website too, votersnotpoliticians.com/find the petition. Find the petition. Petition. So if you want to know where they're going to be, you could do a preemptive strike yourself, not with nuclear weapons, but go out and you find them and you sign the petition if you're in favor of it. So you can probably read the complete petition at their website, votersnotpoliticians.com. Major breakthrough, and that was one of the stories in Detroit Metro Times, which now, by the way, has at least 10, count them 10, not just two or three, really good journalistic pieces every week. And the paper is free. Plus, so, well, I don't know where to find it. I have to make a big deal to pick it up. It's online, too, metrotimes.com. Highly recommend that to you as part of your weekly reading. If you're concerned at all about local politics, Michigan politics, as well as national politics, it covers a little bit, but they do a great job, including this story, which I haven't seen anywhere else, and I don't know if it was mentioned on commercial media. Just a little bit of public service announcements. The summer semester is ending here at Henry Ford College. I think today, maybe it ended yesterday or the day before, but in any event, it's coming to an end. And the fall semester, whoop-de-doo, is starting up. That's usually the biggest semester with more classes, more offerings, and more students show up too for it, as it turns out, going from August 24th. That's next week, Thursday. That's when classes begin. That begins on Thursday, August 24th. And you need to be enrolled at the beginning, okay? You can't come to the college to register for classes after classes have started. That's something we don't allow, because you don't want to miss any classes. You'd be wasting your money a little bit, right? So definitely you need to maybe come to the campus and be admitted if you're not already admitted. But if you are admitted from even a couple years back, you just have to register online at hfcc.edu. And choose your classes, make your selections now, because they're filling up. There's only 6 days to go before the fall semester begins here. And so don't wait. And to help you with that, today the college is actually open. All the offices are open, including the admissions office. I think they were always open on Fridays, but our admissions office, the registrar's office, too, in our Welcome Center, which is in the north part of our main campus here at 5101 Evergreen, that's just south of Ford Road in Dearborn. If you need to be admitted, the Welcome Center is a place to go. If you have any registration questions that can't be answered on the website, hfcc.edu, you can email them. enrollmentservices@hfcc.edu. But if you want to come in person, they used to call them Super Saturdays. Tomorrow is the last Super Saturday. The admissions office in the Welcome Center at Henry Ford College will be open tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And if you've never been admitted here, if you bring enough ID with you to indicate your place of residence and who you are and that you are you, That's the most important part. Are you you? Some people aren't sure. Well, so Saturday, August 19th, tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., the Welcome Center at Henry Ford College is open for admissions or enrollment in a semester or any other advice. The financial aid office is there too if you want to get started on processing an application for financial aid, which it's a little late now for it to kick in before our classes start, but once you get it started, then in some cases, loan funds or other kinds of funds can sort of catch up once you're approved, if you are approved, of course. So consider that. It's a step forward. Future-driven is that slogan here at Henry Ford College. And guess who's doing the driving? You are. So remember, hfcc.edu, fall semester starts August 24th. Well, I'm going to slide back to Jack Lessenberry because he's had an editorial also from a couple days ago, a podcast that talked about John Conyers. And you may have heard, you know, he does represent a part of the Dearborn area, sort of the east side of Dearborn and into Detroit. That's how his district was gerrymandered. And this is about his ethical problems. Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Public Radio.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. The world was a far different place half a century ago, and Detroit was reeling after the nation's most devastating urban riots. Michigan was a far richer state than it is now. It usually wasn't hard to get a job on the line assembling Pontiacs or Oldsmobiles. Virtually nobody drove Hondas or Datsuns, which is what Toyotas were then called. Mitt Romney's father was governor, though Mitt himself was too young to vote. Michigan had more clout in Washington and five more members of Congress than it does now. Everyone then serving in Congress is now dead or long since retired, with one exception. John Conyers, who was in Congress then and still is now at age 88, with apparently no plans to retire, possibly ever. Conyers has had a long and storied career. He worked in the civil rights movement with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and was the member of Congress most responsible for making King's birthday a federal holiday. He has justly called the nation's attention to that most American of all art forms, jazz. There's no doubt that the world's a better place for Conyers having lived in it. But the currently longest-serving member of Congress is now under investigation for ethical problems. In March of last year, his longtime chief of staff, Cynthia Martin, pleaded guilty to receiving stolen property. The next month, she was fired. But Conyers authorized her remaining on the federal payroll until nearly the end of August at more than $13,000 a month, paid for by the taxpayers, when she was apparently doing no work. When the board of the Office of Congressional Ethics attempted to investigate, they say Conyers refused to cooperate with them in any way whatsoever. The board then voted unanimously to ask the ethics panel to continue looking into this case. After that, an attorney for Conyers sent a letter claiming this was just a case of someone receiving their normal severance and vacation pay. Congressmen on the committee then said they needed more time to review the report, which is very clear and only 7 pages long. I have no idea how this will turn out, though I suspect that lots of congressmen would like this all swept under the rug. I also know what many other reporters know. Conyers' offices have long been a chaotic mess. He's gotten into trouble before for using staff improperly. 11 years ago, a former staffer complained she was ordered to live in Conyers' home for 6 weeks and take care of his children while the congressman's wife was in law school. His payroll management has been so erratic that the office would sometimes overspend its maximum budget for the year, and staffers had to be temporarily let go. There are many other stories, some far more lurid, but the current Ethics Committee is only allowed to look into things that have happened in the last 9 years. And somehow, Conyers has been Teflon. 3 years ago, his career seemed over when his staffers failed to collect enough legitimate signatures to get him on the primary ballot for Congress. But a sympathetic federal judge put him on anyway. John Conyers will be almost 90 when his current term ends. Does it really make sense for him to stay any longer?
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
That was from August 11th, okay, from Jack Lessenberry. And we knew some of these before. I thought I would just review them. I do think that John Conyers, his long, long career, there's many, many things that he's done that's been very good for our area and for the country. Yes, a Democrat. Yes, a progressive Democrat. Sometimes to the point of getting in a little trouble, but a little controversy. But yes, there's some ethical issues here. Well, I just thought I would let you review that. Coming up on his schedule, as well as Senator Bernie Sanders, is a special appearance right here in Detroit, not far from Henry Ford College. In fact, I don't think it's on West Outer Drive in Detroit, 7707 West Outer Drive. It's going to be next Tuesday, August 22nd. Okay, next Tuesday, August 22nd, 2017, of course, this year. It's going to be from 7 to 9 p.m. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. And why is that? Well, you know, the last time Bernie Sanders was in Dearborn was during, of course, his campaign to become the nominee of the Democratic Party for president last year. And at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center, we had to arrive, was it 2 or 3 or 4 hours in advance? Because, well, it's a big auditorium, and there was a couple thousand people waiting to get in. I was one of them, of course, and because as a journalist, would-be journalist, I wanted to see the crowd. I wanted to see what was happening. I wanted to hear Bernie Sanders in person for over an hour and a half. And it was a spellbinding performance, and most of the people there from Dearborn area, because I recognized a lot of them, all 1,200, no, not necessarily, but they were all big supporters. I haven't seen a turnout that big for a single candidate in Dearborn since Ron Paul came by, the Republican. And he had unbelievable support, at least that evening, from people in Dearborn and the surrounding area. Well, it's going to be a town hall, which means, yes, questions can be asked of perhaps both gentlemen. So, but you probably will have to go through a security check. I mean, don't carry any little pocket knives. I had a little knife I used to open boxes and letters. It was like an inch long, and it was on my keychain. And, of course, they confiscated it because, you know, inch-long knives. Not illegal in Dearborn, by the way, but they could do damage, I guess. Anyway, so you might have to go through a magnetic gate, and we didn't have to take off our shoes, I believe. But they pat you down and so on. So it might take a little time. But again, this is going to be a town hall with Senator Bernie Sanders and Congressman John Conyers. It's going to be this Tuesday, August 22nd, from 7 to 9 p.m., but doors open at 5:30 p.m., and I'd suggest if you want to be part of this, it's free, of course, but they do want you to sign up an RSVP. Okay, I'll give you that information in a minute. But again, it's going to be at Fellowship Chapel Church. Fellowship Chapel Church. That's in Detroit. It's at 7707 West Outer Drive, Detroit, Michigan, 48235. And the notice came from BernieSanders.com. It's part of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Especially this topic was all about Medicare for all. That is improving our healthcare system to the same quality and much less expensive system that many other countries of the world have that shame us, such as Canada, such as France, England, Germany. Get the idea? Yeah. Healthcare for all. Everybody's covered. Everybody has access to great healthcare, and it costs less. And, prescription drugs included, too, of course. But that was one of the things that, of course, the President Trump was promising. When he was campaigning, of course, when he was campaigning. And, of course, the only way to get there with better health care for all at lower cost is to do universal single-payer health care. It only makes sense. And it's been proven. It's been proven. And you say, well, with this country or that country, their systems, this part of it isn't good. We can pick and choose the best parts of all the top 3-4 healthcare systems of the world and make it ours. We can steal their ideas. In fact, Michael Moore in his last feature film suggests we steal the good ideas that the other world has already proven for our country and we put them in place. And this is obviously one of them. So it's supposedly going to be an opportunity to talk about healthcare, but they may be talking about jobs and the economy also, and the importance of moving the United States to this single-payer system, which is also referred to and could be seen as, and this would be an easy first step, though, even though it would need improvements, Medicare for all. Also talk about rebuilding our infrastructure and creating more jobs for working people in Detroit and around the country. So last but not least, one more time, town hall with Senator Bernie Sanders and Congressman John Connors is coming Tuesday, August 22nd, 7 to 9 p.m. Doors open at 5:30. Fellowship Chapel Church in Detroit, 7707 West Outer Drive. They want you to RSVP. That is, respondez s'il vous plaît. So get back to them. Let them know that you're coming. So they have enough chairs, I guess. And I would recommend that the website you respond to is berniesanders.com. It's SANDERS.com. Okay, another issue that came up here, and it was kind of unusual, but in an editorial opinion from the News Herald, that's right, the News Herald, the Downriver newspaper of record for, you know, Lincoln Park, Allen Park, Taylor, all those downriver communities, they had an editorial opinion, which is a letter from a gentleman who was identified as a software engineer, you know, techie, from Seattle. I didn't know there was a downriver community called Seattle. I bet there isn't. But his name is Chris Craig, and his reference here is to Debbie Dingell. I think he's got some things wrong. Oh, let's go back and spell check here. Fact check, okay, because this is not fake news. We don't do fake news. No. Jack Lessenberry quickly said, and he's not a car guy, and I am. He mentioned in his editorial there back in the olden days that Datsun, you know, one of those foreign cars from Japan, and he indicated it was made by Toyota. No, Toyota has always been Toyota. Datsun was a name that the Japanese company Nissan came up with because they didn't think people would buy Nissan cars. That sounds too Japanese. So what name did they come up with? Datsun. Now, which sounds more Japanese or less Japanese to you? Nissan or Datsun? Duh. Well, it sort of dawned on them, but I think into the 70s somewhere, they had to just go back to Nissan because that's who they are. That's what they've always been called as a corporation. And just wanted to correct that. Not Toyota. Toyota has their own car company, and Nissan has theirs. There, we got the facts straight. Okay, back to Craig here. His name is Chris Craig, and he's talking about not selling the sky. Well, here's what he says in his opinion, which is now on the website in the newsherald.com. He says, efficiency, compassion, timeliness, and integrity. These are all words that nobody in their right mind would ever associate with today's airline industry. He probably thought I was going to say U.S. president. No, no. Efficiency, compassion, timeliness, and integrity. And yet, he says, just recently, a House panel voted to put the major commercial airlines in charge of air control, air traffic control, nationwide. So in other words, this is the brilliant idea, as he calls it brilliant, which is obviously a satiric term here. All air traffic control, both in terms of safety and the collection of fees, would be handed over to a private corporation that the major airlines themselves largely control. This basically places the very sky itself, he says, under the authority of the same geniuses who brought us such innovations as, quote, non-internet booking fees, unquote, and dragging customers off of overbooked flights. Only an abject fool would entrust the people responsible for one of America's most failed industries with such unchecked power. History has shown time and again that privatization, wherever you do it, does not work. Simply does not work. It's finally not responsive to the people. If it's a public issue, if it's a public health or safety issue, I'm adding. Did I already say, and it's over halfway through our hour, did I already say that all opinions on the show are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford College, faculty, staff, administrators, or students? But maybe it is for some of them. In any event, this is the opinion of Chris Craig from Seattle. And he goes on to say about this, that he said, a perfect example is our private health care system. So this segues, as they say in radio, to the last story we did. He says, by leaps and bounds, it's the most economically inefficient in the industrialized world. The notion that private corporations always do things better is an all too common myth. And you might say, oh, wait, it's Obamacare. That's all government controlled. Wrong. Didn't you? This is my opinion coming in. Didn't you realize that Obama could only get the changes if he had support from the private industries, the private health insurance people and the private pharma people who make the drugs, healthcare system, private, you know, only working with them did they come up with that plan. And did they hate it? No, they loved it because they're still making all the profits in the world under Obamacare. And they get to raise their rates whenever they want to on top of it. So don't tell me that Obamacare was government health care. No, it was just a reshuffling and trying for an improvement, trying to get more people with health insurance and that protection, that life protection. And it was a compromise because Obama had to negotiate with Republican majority in one of the houses of Congress. And I think they had Democrats in the Senate and they had Republicans in the House. How did they get the Republicans on their side? By getting the support of all the big business interests. So we've always had privately controlled health care in this country, with the exception of Medicare. Okay. But even that, all the doctors are, you know, in private practice and blah, blah, blah. Yes, there's rules and regulations in Medicare. But that's only a small part of the people of our country that are in Medicare, Medicare. And then Medicaid, that's a little bit of support there. But Obamacare added about 20, 30 million, 22 million, I think was the last official count. And at least people had some coverage, and even if they had pre-existing conditions. So a few of the reforms of Obamacare, which was actually called the Affordable Care Act, making health insurance affordable to 22 million more people, is not an example of the failure of a government-controlled system. You got that clear? Got that in your head? I mean, do the research. Don't trust me. Never trust anybody on radio or TV. But if we stimulate you to think, check it out for yourself. You know, how many TV, cable TV pundits will encourage you to check it out for yourself? Okay, not many, but we do here at WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Independent, non-commercial, that makes the difference. If you're not independent and non-commercial media, then you can be criticized. And in fact, you can be swayed, you can be influenced by commercial powers. Well, Chris Craig goes on to say, another problem is that the same airlines that brag about inventing new fees to compensate for a fundamentally broken business model would essentially have the power to collect from anyone who wants to fly, including licensed pilots in their own private planes, which groups like the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association strongly oppose. If you were to charter a private flight out of Willow Run Airport, for example, either you or the pilot would still be on the hook for whatever fees the airlines demand. Unsurprisingly, the major airlines are willing to pay large sums of money to persuade, that's in quotes, members of Congress to let them have their way again. The power of private corporate money in influencing government decisions, he adds. So, Chris Craig says that's why it's important for voters to examine their representatives' campaign contributions and make sure that they're held accountable. Thankfully, Congressman Debbie Dingell has accepted less money from the airline PACs than most of her colleagues. But it is still incumbent upon us to make sure she understands how important it is not to sell the American people's skies for another palmful of magic beans and empty promises. Yeah, how did she vote when this came out of committee? He doesn't say here. Okay. How will she vote? Now, she's a Democrat. I believe this proposal sounds to me like privatization of air traffic control with putting the airlines themselves in charge. Isn't that putting the rooster in charge of the hen house? Come on. It sounds to me like a Republican plan, because they believe privatization always works, and it clearly doesn't. Do the research. Okay, do the math, says Kornick. Certainly air traffic control? Oh, my goodness. This is serious stuff. This is life and death, air traffic control. Yes, I know there's the extra fees and the costs and charges, but this is life and death. We need a responsible, heavily regulated, governmental organization to control this and to legitimize it. And with decent pay for the air traffic controllers, which is that's one of the most stressful jobs in the whole U.S., along with your police and firemen. But they've got to be good, and they got to know what they're doing. And so even if Mr. Craig lives in Seattle, he's keeping up on Debbie Dingell, apparently, and he's letting us know about things. He mentions, Willow Run, which is a private, more or less a private airline airport out in Ypsilanti. And he does give Debbie Dingell's phone number in Washington, D.C. It says, call Debbie Dingell and tell her not to outsource our safety to the airline industry. It's just one of those issues that's important besides all the other big issues that are important. And to add to that point, Michael Moore, and Michael Moore, certainly Michigan residents, grew up in Flint, Michigan. Now he's living in Traverse City, still a filmmaker. He's got a Broadway show right now in which he tells a few opinions of his own about the world. And he changes things night to night. I can only imagine what he's been saying this week, except you have to pay probably $160 a seat to see him in New York City in the theater. But nonetheless, he appeared on TV on MSNBC this last Monday night. And by the way, he's not wearing his baseball caps quite as much. It is sort of a signature thing for him, and he changes the caps from one to another. But he does have a goodly amount of hair. He's got sort of a boyish bob, and at his age, he needs that, certainly. Well, here's what he said. Michael Morris, primary reason or that he did appear on MSNBC's Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell, he said, take this horror moment that we're in and times it by 20, times it by 200. That's what's going on in every federal agency that's under the control of President Trump every day. So he went on to urge Americans to keep their eyes on the entirety of President Donald Trump's policy agenda, even as, quote, our attention is rightly on what's going on in Virginia and around the country. He went on to say, please know that on every one of these days, Donald Trump is very busy doing a whole bunch of other things that we're not paying attention to. Today, that is last Monday, Donald Trump's Environmental Protection Agency did something that will suffer from years from now. His Interior Department sold off land of ours to people who shouldn't have it. Just go down all the cabinet departments. Every day, there's something going on. And so you can watch the full interview on MSNBC. Probably YouTube has it too. Again, that's Lawrence O'Donnell's show on MSNBC from last Monday. Others echoed Moore's call in the aftermath of the deadly violence perpetrated by white supremacists over the weekend. Vox's Matt Egelis argued Monday that the real things Trump has gotten done often go unnoticed amid the bluster and erratic behavior. Yeah, some people, if I may add, suggest that it's a cover-up. His tweets are all a cover-up to distract us from all the other stuff that he's actually doing that's causing great harm, according to many people, within our government every day. The article concludes, nearly all of these accomplishments are making it easier for, quote, mining companies to dump pollution into streams, unquote, to gutting an Obama-era rule that, quote, would have made it illegal for financial advisors to deliberately rip off their customers, are overwhelmingly things that help incumbent businesses get over on the public interests, according to Matt Egelis from Vox. So that article I found on commondreams.org, which is another one of those great web sources for information about the world. Yes, they probably have a liberal bias, if you will, but they collect from a variety of websites, and sometimes they write their own articles. This was an amalgam of a couple articles, and their staff writer, Jake Johnson, did it. Common Dreams is based in Maine, and they are a complete nonprofit organization. We love nonprofits, especially here at WHFR, since we are a nonprofit ourselves. But good things to keep in mind there. Let's see. About 15 minutes to the end of the hour, well, 17 minutes, what the heck. Coming up at 2 o'clock today is Highway 61 with Kitty Love, Best in the Blues, from 2 to 4 today. And following that on WHFR.fm, from 4 to 6, Mike Holloway with more blues, great blues, going with the flow, as he calls his show. A somewhat long article that I'll just have to summarize. Appeared on thenation.com, and there's another liberal journal. But they have a great website, great email. A lot of these things, people say, well, I don't like subscribe. I don't want to go to the library to have to get a copy. It's all free, folks, these days, because there's banner ads and other things that pop up, but you don't have to pay attention to those. The information is free if you've got a computer and an internet connection, of course. So I highly recommend thenation.com, along with the couple dozen other websites that I've recommended to you, because you need to keep up. I can't do it all in 1 hour. Nope. But they had a great story. Let's see. From the 15th. What day was that? Oh, time passes so quickly. Was that Tuesday? Anyway. The question is, could a universal basic income, UBI, universal basic income, work in the U.S.? You know, they've got some test trials of it in various places in Canada right now, where they had a person who's a big advocate there for, a couple decades, one of their politicians, in fact. And we'll see how that works out. So here's the story, the summary. And I've covered universal basic income a couple times on the show in the last year, because I think it's an idea that's time has come, especially because of the continued march ahead, if you want to call it that, ahead, behind, whatever, the continued march for automation, not just robots, but automation of all sorts, because that's affecting our job situation. So how can we guarantee a living wage, a living income, for people in the future, not just tomorrow, or in 10 years, but 20 years, 30, 40, 50 years from now, as these trends continue, we're going to have a lot of people that are going to be displaced from work. And so what do we do? One of the ideas is to at least have a solid support floor of income from the government to everybody. I know. Is the idea of cash handouts for everyone, no strings attached, a breakthrough solution for unemployment and social inequality, or a road to profligacy, laziness, and idleness, attracting left, right, and center? The idea of a universal basic income, again, UBI, if you want to abbreviate it, is the perfect Rorschach test in the public debate over the future of work. For Americans, the universal benefits might just outweigh the universal costs. The UBI model is radically simple, a basic payment designed to cover basic expenses. After giving each to each person according to need, people are freer to give according to ability. UBI evangelists argue that automatically providing for basic nutritional and shelter needs liberates people to ascend the hierarchy of needs and focus on more valuable activities like developing social relationships and civic and cultural engagement. Others hope a UBI would foster a more harmonious, cooperative, post-work society simply by countering scarcity and selfishness. The idea of free cash has inherent public appeal. Surveys by the Economic Security Project show that 46% of respondents favored giving every individual a base income, as it's called, especially among youth and people of color, while 35% were opposed. So far, researchers have primarily focused on UBI pilot projects in the global south. Now the Roosevelt Institute has probed the question of how the system might work in a rich but fiercely unequal capitalistic society. Could Americans be trusted to give as well as receive universally? So it's a question. But the results in from a couple of studies already done, and I'm summarizing now to move on quickly with this. For example, they mentioned the Alaska Permanent Fund Dividend, which according to the profits that they get in Alaska from allowing all that oil to be pumped out, it gives every resident an annual payment of $1,000 or $2,000. Also, they mentioned the Eastern Band of Cherokees. They have a casino dividend program which divides income generated from the reservation's gambling industry and issues payments of several thousand dollars to each member annually. And there's also what's called negative income tax programs piloted in, that I mentioned before, select Canadian and U.S. communities in the 1960s and 70s, in which local authorities provided taxpayer-funded household rebates that covered basic living expenses. And the results are have actually been pretty amazing so far. And studies are still being done, as I said, big test studies in Canada. But they do believe that people will not, if given the basic income, go crazy. maybe a couple of people will. But that it actually works out to encourage them to get educated, find better jobs, useful jobs. If you've got that solid floor of protection for living expenses and food, then you can get on to the rest of your life and better things. You don't have to steal stuff. You don't have to, get stressed out or lose your mind about anything. It's an amazing idea, and it probably will be working elsewhere in the world before we finally even think about it. Because we love that inequality, don't we? We love the lack of opportunity. I guess, because that's what we're stuck with right now. And we've got to get off the dime. We need to take a look at universal basic income. By the way, this was a proposal, and I have to say this, and I said it once before, I think, that came up in the political campaign of 1972. The presidential candidate from the Democratic Party, George McGovern. Okay. He lost horribly. What a defeat in terms of votes. But to the Republican, and you know who that was. Well, I don't even remember. I try to forget. But George McGovern, one of his platform proposals was a guaranteed basic income for everybody instead of the welfare system. Talk about a government mess and government control and government costs, the management, it's not even feasible as a good idea or an efficient idea. So do away with all that welfare stuff and give everybody a basic income. And again, you can test this in a few cities or a few states and see what happens. It will take a few years to get that basic income level and according to need worked out, 5-10 years perhaps. But it really seems like a good idea whose time has come. And Daniel P. Monahan, who was a great politician, and I think he was elected representative from House or Senate for a while. I know he was an ambassador to the UN for a while. He did studies on this. He was a sociologist, too, in his spare time. He did studies on this in the U.S. that it clearly was better than welfare in various cases where he studied it in the United States. And that was 50-some years ago. Did it change anything? No. Nobody didn't catch on. But other countries got caught on to it, and it looks like it's going to be happening, and maybe pretty big in Canada in just a couple of years. And it actually costs less than welfare to have a universal basic income. Less than welfare. Oh, my goodness. That takes my breath away. Well, with only about 6 minutes to go, we don't want to lose our breath until the end. Okay. Jack Lessenberry, finally, has an article that's very moving. One of his opinions from the Detroit Metro Times from July 26. Okay, a little way back. But even the Arab American National Museum recommended, and I think the League of Women Voters, too, Dearborn Heights has recommended this particular editorial. So I'm going to read it to you. and it's entitled Why Immigrants Are the Best Thing to Happen to Michigan. The other night I was watching Mel Brooks' hilariously funny Blazing Saddles movie, possibly the most politically incorrect movie ever made. The N-word is used more often in the opening scenes than Donald Trump says, trust me, in a week. Yet somehow, it isn't really offensive because the movie is poking fun at us and our weakness as a society. Every sexist and racist stereotype is gleefully invoked, parodied, and therefore effectively demolished. When it was over, I suddenly realized something. Sadly, that movie could never be made today. Not because we're more enlightened, but because we no longer are self-confident enough as a people and a nation to laugh at ourselves. Not that everything was peachy when Blazing Saddles was being made. The film was released when the country was neck deep in the Watergate scandal. Inflation was rising, America's participation in the Vietnam War had ended just a year earlier, and we all knew it was a horrible failure. Yet we still believed in the idea of America and that this was the best nation in the world. The next year, when the tottering corpse of South Vietnam finally collapsed, we took in thousands of refugees. We knew immigrants had made this nation great. Not anymore. Flash forward four decades to a nation whose president won his office in large part by stirring up everything in the dark recesses of the American soul. That meant, first of all, attacking immigrants and blaming them for social, you know, society's ills. Gets me so choked up. Donald Trump ran the nastiest anti-immigrant campaign this nation has seen since the Know Nothing movement back before the Civil War. Look that one up. That's capital K, capital N, the Know Nothing movement. He managed to make millions feel that Muslims were terrorists and Mexicans, drug dealers, and rapists. What's more, he made people feel that immigrants, legal as well as illegal, were taking their jobs and vowed to crack down on immigration and get Americans their jobs back. Enough people in the right places believed him to put him in the White House. Yes, we will be sorting out and dealing with the ramifications of that for the rest of our lives. We can, as a result, only hope that the babies being born this year will someday live in the United States of America with a government they can be proud of. But that's not the topic today. Immigration is. What I fear is that people will still believe Trump's lies about immigrants and immigration even after he is discredited and disgraced, is hauled out of office, is defeated, dies, or decides to leave of his own accord. So now, here's the truth. And this is in italics, folks. Those big-time slanted letters. Immigrants are, right now, perhaps more than ever, the best thing to happen to Michigan. Okay, back to lowercase, no italics. They create more jobs than native-born Americans. They improve communities, start businesses, and invent things needed to make us economically competitive again. That's been clear to everyone who worked with immigrant communities for a long time. But now we have documented proof of that. Earlier this month, the Michigan Economic Center, a nonprofit based in Ann Arbor, released a carefully researched study on immigration's impact on the state. The study, Michigan, we are all migrants here, conclusively shows that we would be in a lot worse shape without the immigration we've had in recent years. John Austin, who was until January president of the State Board of Education, founded the center and is a main author of the study. Quote, Michigan relies on legal immigrants to grow our economy. We literally cannot afford policies that discourage them from coming or that chase away those who are here, unquote. According to Austin. The study, which Austin did in collaboration with former state rep Steve Dubuckman's group Global Detroit, effectively exposes many myths about immigrants as blatant lies. Far from being a drain on Michigan, immigrants are essential to its economy. Detroit hasn't stopped losing people in the last few years, but the outflow has slowed dramatically. This is, however, almost entirely due to immigrants. Detroit's immigrant population grew by 13% between 2010 and 2014. The native-born kept heading for the exits. Statewide, the picture was much the same. Michigan's foreign-born population has grown nearly 25% since 2002, which more than accounts for what growth there's been. That doesn't mean they're taking over. Far from it, Michigan has the smallest percentage of its population born outside of this country of any state except Louisiana. That's only 650,000 people, or just over 6%. But as Austin likes to say, economically they, quote, punch above their weight. Unquote. About 31,000 are self-employed, and they employ some 150,000 people. Immigrants are, the study says, responsible for nearly all the net new growth in mid-sized so-called Main Street businesses. They aren't just running hotels and hiring counter help. They're creating the economy of the future. Immigrants are behind 25% of the state's high-tech startups. They are the owners are co-owners of more than three-quarters of the patents issued to the state's top research universities. They are, on average, better educated than the native-born, especially in science, technology, engineering, and math, so-called STEM area and jobs. They are, in short, Detroit and Michigan's economic future, if we are to have one. Governor Rick Snyder can be a bumbler, but he understood that much. To his credit, he tried, unsuccessfully, in 2014 to get Washington to give Michigan 50,000 extra visas for skilled or educated immigrants. To be sure, some immigrants aren't well-educated. One of the curious findings of the study was that while immigrants, on average, have more education than a native-born, a higher percentage of them have less than a high school degree. But the study notes that, quote, research strongly indicates that far from being an economic drain, these immigrants are important to many Michigan industries, unquote, because they are willing to do the jobs those born here are seldom willing to do. Few Michigan immigrants are undocumented, a.k.a. illegal, but that doesn't mean Trump's persecutions don't have an effect. Austin told me that after dozens of Chaldeans were rounded up and arrested in the Detroit suburbs last month, that, quote, sent a chilling message to Michigan's legal immigrants, current and future, you are not welcome here, unquote. Trump's anti-immigrant policies are, in fact, more damaging to Michigan than most places. What the Michigan Economic Center study recommends is that the politicians collaborate with business leaders to make this the most welcoming state in the nation. Otherwise, we may get to see immigrants fleeing or shunning our state. And that's Jack Lesenberry's opinion from the Metro Times. You can follow him there regularly. It's just about all the time we have for today's show. And in fact, I need to mention that this is, I guess, my last show at WHFR. I've been teaching here at Henry Ford College as full and adjunct instructor for 49 years now. I've been the station advisor for WHFR for 41 years, and we've been broadcasting for 32 years. So I think I've done something. I thank all of you loyal listeners and supporters of WHFR. I hope you continue. I know that the show will continue. I know that our programming will always be non-commercial and independent. So keep listening. And adios, adieu, and farewell. I mean that seriously, farewell.
This is WHFR Dearborn. You are listening to the magic of radio. Time.